For the benefit of those listening to this recording on the Sacramento Valley Intergroup website, this was recorded during the Recovery of the Body, Mind, and Spirit event on May 22, 2021. It is my pleasure to introduce Melissa C. from New York, who will share her experience, strength, and hope on her recovery of the mind.
Thank you so much. That was just, let me just say, that was really beautiful and moving, and it's a privilege and an honor to follow such a beautiful message. Thank you. My name is Melissa C. I am a recovered compulsive overeater. I live in New York, and I'm going to start off. I always like to share my photos because it's a powerful, to me, a powerful visual demonstration of what it means to experience the miraculous, you know? And so this is, let me see. Okay, so these are, hopefully they'll pop up. This is what it looks like to live in a body that's suffering with the disease of compulsive overeating, to, you know, to have, I looked in the Brown Book, right? And the appendix at the end, or page 197, it says, once people become compulsive overeaters, every aspect of their lives is affected. Now they get into psychological, physical, and environmental problems and start changing their lives, their friends, and their social structures. All these changes are really caused by compulsive overeating. So compulsive overeating has impacted every area of my life. You know, here's me when I had just given birth to my daughter. She's 20 now. I swore, I'm a really intelligent woman. I want you to know, I've been dieting since I'm 9 years old. I know everything about nutrition. I know what foods are problematic for me. I had incredible motivation, you know, external motivation and internal motivation to get this weight under control, to get my eating managed. I had information, right? Support, lots of great things. And I swore when I gave birth to her that there was no way I was going to be a fat mom and I would lose that weight, right? And here I am, she's a little bit older. Here I am in the pink. I did not lose the weight. I gained it. I gained more. And this was my life. And the disease of compulsive overeating, being enslaved to the food, had me truly living in bondage. This is what it looks like to live in bondage. You know, I was dominated by this never-ending, never-satisfied need to consume more and more food. And it had me hating myself. I hated myself. I felt deep shame and embarrassment. I felt, you know, I felt like I took up too much space in the world. That's an awful way to experience life. Like you somehow are infringing upon the rights of others just by your walking into the room. That's what it felt like. You know, I would walk onto a plane. You know, I'm just gonna share some of these as well. I would walk onto a plane and walk down the aisle of the plane. Now I was over 300 pounds at my highest. Here I had my son. Clearly I didn't lose weight from having my daughter, right? Now I had a son and I was heavier. I would walk onto a plane and I could see people's eyes and their expression like, God, don't let her sit next to me, right? Don't let her sit next to me. And you know what? I understood how they felt because what I was thinking in my head was, buddy, if I could have chosen a seat that wasn't next to me, I would have done it too, right? Like I didn't even want to be next to me. And that's just, that's a horrendous way to walk through life. I would be at family gatherings. Here I am with my sisters. I have a big family, lots of siblings, lots of nieces, lots of nephews, lots of loud, lots of mistakes, lots of love, lots of wrongs, lots of everything. And they did the best they could, but everybody in my family, they truly have always loved me. And I would experience social gatherings, family gatherings, needing to numb out in the food. I felt overwhelmed by happy, sad, by everything. And I felt separate, alone, and detached from the people that God had placed, literally, boom, right in my life. And I couldn't experience being with them. So that oftentimes at these family occasions, I was reliving everything that everyone ever did to me. Go back till I was three. I got it in my pocket, a list of everything that anyone ever did, real or imagined. And I would also experience some of these events needing to drink and needing to eat. And I would actually sometimes be in the bathroom at family gatherings, having to shove extra food in my mouth because I knew everybody, or I believed everybody, was sort of looking and thinking, God, she got fat. She's still eating. So I had to spend time in the bathroom, you know, and this was the way I experienced life. You know, I gained in high school, I gained 100 pounds. I lost in my early 20s, I lost 130 pounds. And then I got married and I regained 160 in my early years of marriage. I had dangerously high blood pressure. I snored myself awake at night. I had painful joints. You know, now my environmental problems, family relations, right? Living in isolation. I had a lot of experiences. The big book talks about frothy emotional appeal seldom sufficing. I had a lot of people who gave me frothy emotional appeal. They would sit me down to try to give me a good talking to, but it didn't work. It never, ever worked. In fact, after those really heartfelt good talking tos that those people did, I resented them and I had to go and eat because how dare you? How dare you was really what I was thinking. Don't you tell me what I should do. And I ate at them, but truly I was so ashamed and so uncomfortable. You know, at the end, you know, it's at the end, the most beautiful blessing happened. And I know I'm specifically talking about the disease of the mind. At the end of my rope for me, I started experiencing panic attacks. And that was a gift from God. It was a tap on the shoulder because I always thought that my brain was really okay. I thought it was my body. I thought it was somehow if I get, I lived in this idea, someday when I lose weight, someday when I get my eating under control. And I reached a point where I couldn't think straight anymore. I just couldn't stand another minute being alive in my body. And around that time, I experienced a miracle. I started hearing, I mean, I had been in and out of OA, but I started hearing a different message. I started calling into a phone meeting and it was a powerful meeting. And I heard people say recovered. And I was like, what? That, how dare they? How dare they? You know, I almost was offended by the notion that you could recover. But I heard something in them and I wanted desperately what they had. And so if I wanted what they had, I started doing what they did without negotiation, without debate, without taking it through, you know, this, I had this little thing in my head that I would take it through like the board of directors in my brain. I dismissed my thinking and I said, I'm gonna do it. I'm just gonna follow directions. And so this is me today, right? This is pretty much what I've looked like for the last number of years. I mean, what's truly the miracle is, yes, I'm in a normal size body. That's incredible. The food is quiet. I don't care about the food. I can go to family events. I'm happy to be with the people in my life. That's miraculous. To feel happy to be with other people, to feel, and guess what, even sometimes upset with them, but a genuine experience. I'm feeling life like a human being, like a real human being. You know, being overweight my whole life and struggling that, it was always the number one problem. I believed that when I got my weight down, my life would be fine. And so here's my question, right? Why was it that I knew that there were foods that had a powerful effect on me? I've known it since I was a little girl. I tell this story that my mom would take out a cake on Friday nights And my experience of this cake, my mother would take it out, and before the first slice was cut, I knew I didn't have enough. That's how I experienced food. Before it was in my mouth, I was already craving more than what was in my mouth. So I experienced my life like this. Here's my plate, and everything was right beyond my plate for me. And I didn't just live with food that way. I lived life that way. I never felt like what I got was enough. There was a longing, a deep longing, and a hunger for more. You know, I want to draw your attention to the dangerous truth that how this disease of compulsive eating, it is a form of mental illness. This is a form of mental illness. Now, funny enough, in the big book, right, it describes what insanity is. If you're thinking, I'm not insane, no way. It's really clear. And it's in the story about Jim, who decides that he can put a little whiskey into his milk. And it tells me right there what's insanity: lacking proportion and having an inability to think straight. So here's what it would look like for me, right? Lacking proportion, meaning I give extra value to things that are not valuable, and I diminish the value of things that are truly valuable. What could be more valuable than my life, right? What is it? And I loved, Rosette, the idea, I am living in a miracle. I feel that, right? So here I am walking around in this miracle that my creator gifted me, and I treat it like garbage. I have no proportion. Right. And here's what it would look like. Knowing what I know in early abstinence, right, I know I have a problem with specific foods. I would walk into events thinking, I can't insult the host and ask what's in it. I'm going to have to eat whatever they put in front of me. Right. Because I lack proportion. I believe that somehow my life has less value than the possibility of, you know, asking the host what it is that they're serving, right? That's lacking proportion. You know, I would make things less important and give value to things that weren't important, and an inability to think straight. Well, clearly, if I kept returning to the thing that I knew was killing me, I had an inability to think straight. Now I want to tell you, you know, I have advanced degrees, right? I'm a pretty intelligent woman. Do you know how many times I went on the cabbage soup diet? I mean, I have yet to meet a person ever, ever who has had success on the cabbage soup diet, but I bought it every time. That's insanity, right? I had this idea in the disease that if it was expensive and insane, it's gotta work. So if you charged me a lot of money for it and it made no sense and you gave me no evidence, don't even show me anybody that had success with it, I was all in. I would write you a check. I mean, that to me is insanity, right? You know, also the definition of insane is not being able to recall memories, right? Not being able to remember what something does. So I don't have a memory I can rely on. My memory, as far as food is concerned, is only reliable in hindsight, not when I can apply it. It's not a memory that I can call upon to keep me safe and protected. You know, there's another part that says that, you know, that if only I stay on guard. Well, here's the thing, right? Who's on guard when you're staying on guard? Right? Me. I've locked myself in with a crazy person. If you think about staying on guard, it means I've locked out what I perceive as the enemy, and I've locked me in, right, with the problem. And the problem is me. I'm the most dangerous person to this disease that exists really in my mind. You know, it says that these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he'll offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so he can't feel the ache. Well, boy, have I done that, right? What were my alibis? What were my reasons for eating? I'm tired, I'm angry, I'm sad, it's an occasion, right? Anyone, and if you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention, right, of someone like me, I'm gonna laugh it off, I'll become irritated, and sometimes I just refuse to talk, right? When people gave me froth emotional appeal, I would just refuse to talk to them. I take my phone off the hook and not answer. Once in a while though, we might tell the truth, and strange to say, it's usually he has no idea, no idea why I would take that first compulsive bite. I had no understanding what made me do it. Sometimes I had excuses, right, that I was satisfied with part of the time, but in my heart, I really did not know why I did it. And once the malady had a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There's the great obsession that somehow, someday, they're gonna beat the game, but they often suspect that they're down for the count. So, you know, the saddest thing of all, right, is that, yes, my great obsession was someday when I'm thin, and being down for the count was so incredibly painful. And here's the real horrible diseased mind, because when I was down for the count, here's what the disease said: screw it, who cares? And that is the cruelest thoughts. When that thought begins to take root, when the voice inside your brain is telling you, who cares anyway? How do you fight that? How do you battle that, right? And for me, that is where my loving creator came and met me, because somewhere there was the voice that said, I care, I care. You do care, right? You do care. And so this disease, you know, it is a form of mental illness. And I'll tell you how I know it's like mental illness, because I know people I love dearly who suffer have some mental health challenges. And one of the most dangerous things that can happen for them is when they feel good. Because what happens is they say, I don't have to take my medicine anymore. I'm feeling great. And that is sadly what I've seen happen to people in the rooms of in the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous. They say, I'm feeling good. I don't need to do this anymore. Mm-mm. I need to do all of it. In fact, my only hope, by the way, the only thing that could save a woman like me is an act of providence, right? Is a miracle, is God, call it what you will, I call it God, intervention, to grab hold. And if you think about an intervention, it means a come between me and the food, right? That's what was required for me. I needed an awesome power to step in between me and the food. And it happened. I mean, I am living proof. It is real, it happened. And so today, my only hope is, because this disease is progressive, it is a progressive, right? Fatal, permanent, progressive, and patient. I say it's a handsome stalker. It's the boyfriend that wants me back again. And it knows all the right lines. It's gonna tell me, ain't no big thing, girl. Come on, you look cute. Let me just take you out a little bit, right? Sometimes it's like, I think I left my jacket at your house. Whatever it needed to come back in. This disease is cruel, it's brutal. And the only thing that can save me is God, is a miracle. And if I know that, then I chase this miracle today the same way I chased that miracle when I cried out, I can't, who cares anyway? And I heard I do, right? So if you're sitting here and you're thinking, who cares anyway? I do. I do. I do. And so do all of these people. This is real. There is recovery. There is hope for addicts like us. It exists. And thank you. With that, I will pass.